The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When we think about the virus mitigation measures, right, measures being taken like lockdowns, closures of businesses, restrictions on movement of people, things like that, you know, if these things go to dispute resolution, sociologically, it's hard for me to imagine that a tribunal is going to say that these weren't necessary to a legitimate aim of protecting public health, right? I mean, first of all, it seems pretty obvious that there's a public health aim out there. Yeah, the question of necessity is a little bit tricky. Sometimes it can be quite restrictive. But in this context where the emergency is so obvious, it seems unlikely to me that ex post tribunals are going to start kind of questioning whether states were really doing strictly necessary actions, given the zone of uncertainty everybody's in, right? The other side of this is that everybody's taking these actions. This isn't just a disease in one country. This is something affecting every country in the world.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare podcast for May 15th, 2020. The global coronavirus pandemic has changed the way different corners of the world interact with each other, perhaps forever. Nowhere is this more true than the global economy, where a decades-long trend towards the easier exchange of trade and investment was already under increasing political pressure when the pandemic broke, and may now be facing a truly unprecedented set of challenges. To discuss how the global trade and investment systems are being impacted by the coronavirus pandemic, I spoke to three legal experts who have a wealth of private and public sector experience between them. Julian Arato of Brooklyn Law School, Kathleen Clausen of the University of Miami School of Law, and Ben Heath, currently at the NYU School of Law, but soon to be of Temple University Beasley School of Law. It's the Lawfare podcast for May 15th, Global Trade and Investment in the Coronavirus Era. Kathleen, before we get to start talking about the law around the global economy, let's start with some facts so we can have a better understanding about what COVID-19 is doing to international trade and investment. How have we seen it impacting the usual trade investment flows we would be expecting around this time of year between different corners of the world? And what sorts of measures are states implementing that affect those flows in what different ways?
Sure. Well, there are a number of things states have been doing. As you can imagine, trade is down from where it would be expected at this time of year. And you can look at that at the global level. You can look at that at the country by country level. The same is true. But in the era of global supply chains, a lot of states are both importers and exporters of pandemic relevant goods and services. So they have to get things in, right? But then there's a lot that they don't want to let get out. So let me break them down into those two categories. First, as for things not going out, this is really where the focus is, and in many ways, how this crisis differs from trade and investment restrictions that we saw in prior crises. So as of May 14th, and I'm taking these numbers from the Global Trade Alert, which is tracking this closely, they're tracking 83 jurisdictions with 150 different measures that restrict exports of medical equipment, including medicines. And then they've got 27 jurisdictions with 38 different restrictions on food products. So also keeping an eye on these food shortages concerns that some countries are having. Now, what's an example of something along these lines, one of these export constraints? Well, U.S. listeners may be familiar with the export restriction powers given to FEMA, our Federal Emergency Management Agency, that allows FEMA, in cooperation with Customs and Border Protection, to evaluate packages of medical supplies before they leave the United States. And so they're looking to see whether those goods should stay within the U.S. and go to U.S. constituencies. FEMA has used this new authority, which it received last month in April, to stop exports of certain types, things like N95 respirator masks, gloves, that type of thing. So it's been using that already several dozen times, but in the end, many of them, it turns out, have been exported anyway. So it's a sort of stopping point to make sure those things don't leave if we need them in the United States, and other countries have a similar sort of mechanism. What's interesting, just as a as an aside on the FEMA point, is, of course, FEMA is not usually one of our trade agencies. That's not to say they're not engaged, but it's a bit unusual to have FEMA in that role, working together, of course, with Customs. Customs is also engaged in certain temporary deferrals of collecting certain tariffs to also make sure that things are coming in and out. So Customs is engaged as well in that way, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. So that's the major focus right now with all of these, as I mentioned, 83 different jurisdictions around the world with export restraints on medical supplies. Then on the internal or incoming front, let me say just a bit about broad categories of things that countries are doing there. First, you have some countries that are engaged in a reorganization of healthcare and social service networks, so nationalizing private hospitals and other healthcare providers. Spain stands out as an example of one country that's done that on a large scale basis. You have other measures to issue compulsory licenses for medicines, subsidies going to domestic companies, and other forms of economic relief that would be familiar also, I'm sure, to many listeners. Measures that prioritize domestic production in various ways. Lower thresholds for what we call foreign investment screening measures. Now, what do we mean by that in a very brief nutshell? That is that before certain foreign investment might be allowed, now it's easier for the government to stop that foreign investment in various ways. Other types of investment restrictions, as a lot of places are worried that there are undervalued assets that may be bought out. We've seen cancellations of public contracts or concessions, compulsory restrictions on non-essential business activities, again, familiar to many listeners in lockdown. And in places like the UK, pressure on banks to suspend issuance of dividends, and banks have done so there, canceling payouts to shareholders. So other general restrictions of capital flows, a lot of financial services restricted in countries around the world, and other wide-ranging services policies. Many, again, that folks would think non-objectionable, making the internet more widely available, promoting telemedicine, facilitating transport, changing air traffic rules, moving essential personnel across borders, and then finally, tax provisions, of course, to facilitate these as well. So there are others that have been threatened. I won't, that's already a very long list, so we can leave it there. But let me just say that it's also worth mentioning some liberalizing moves. So those ones I've just mentioned are constraining moves, right, that are trying to stop exports and imports in various ways. But we also have, as I mentioned, a lot of folks need supplies to come in. And so there have also been some liberalizing moves that countries have been doing that are less legally problematic than all the things I just said. China and the EU, for example, streaming customs processes for medical goods to get them in more quickly. And then around the world, lifting tariffs on medical supplies. And in the case of the U.S., many of these are some of the special tariffs that were put on during the U.S.-China trade war lists. Question may remain, do they go far enough? These are sort of targeted exclusions from those tariffs rather than a blanket lifting of them, which some have asked for and which the president could do if he so chose. So there you have a pretty large landscape of things states are doing.
So obviously, a number of these tools that states are deploying, particularly the constraining tools you've described, Kathleen, really sound a lot like the sorts of mechanisms we usually associate with economic protectionism, and therefore is a little bit in tension, at least what we usually think of as the dominant trend of the last several decades, and certainly the institutional orientation of the international trade system, which is towards a freer form of trade, less trade barriers in the aggregate, at least. Julian, let me turn to you with this question. Are these measures that Kathleen's described generally legal under the international trade regime? Are there exceptions that allow for these sorts of measures? Are they controversial? And what sorts of legal questions do they pose?
Yeah, so I think focusing on the trade regime, let's focus on the World Trade Organization or the WTO in particular, as well as regional free trade agreements. So just looking at those instruments, a lot of the types of measures that Kathleen was just mentioning surely would be disciplined by those instruments, right? There are obligations of non-discrimination. There are obligations involving exports restrictions. There are obligations in terms of what regulatory obstacles can be erected. Sure. But what really needs to be understood, and is sort of always surprising to me, it's that it's not so well understood outside of international economic lawyers, is that the trade regime, especially in the World Trade Organization, has quite a bit of flexibility built into it. So just because something's disciplined doesn't mean that there's not a possible justification. So the sort of archetypal treaty is the core of the WTO is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, which is the agreement that covers trade in goods. And here, yeah, there's disciplines on non-discrimination at the core of the treaty. There's rules about tariff bindings, et cetera. But there's a really powerful article allowing states to claim a justification for violating those disciplines for all kinds of public regulatory measures, public health, environmental measures, public morals. There's a national security article. And without getting too far into the weeds, the basic idea is if you can point to a legitimate aim that's in the list, and the list is pretty broad, and if you can make the argument that the measure that you took is necessary towards that legitimate aim, and you didn't use it as a sort of way to disguise a restriction on international trade, then you're going to have a justification, right? So that's always been there since 1947 in the GATT, and it's present in some way or another, some version of this means-ends testing, this form of justification, is present one way or another in most of the instruments in the WTO and most free trade agreements. One could get into the details of how all that worked through dispute resolution. There's been volumes written on that. But at the end of the day, justification and flexibility is built into this system. So restrictions can be justified. And just as a sort of sociological matter, you know, when we think about the virus mitigation measures, right, measures being taken like lockdowns, closures of businesses, restrictions on movement of peoples, things like that, you know, if these things go to dispute resolution, sociologically, it's hard for me to imagine that a tribunal is going to say that these weren't necessary to a legitimate aim of protecting public health, right? I mean, first of all, it seems pretty obvious that there's a public health aim out there. Yeah, the question of necessity is a little bit tricky. Sometimes it can be quite restrictive. But in this context where the emergency is so obvious, it seems unlikely to me that ex post tribunals are going to start kind of questioning whether states were really doing strictly necessary actions, given the zone of uncertainty everybody's in, right? The other side of this is that everybody's taking these actions. This isn't just a disease in one country. This is something affecting every country in the world. Every government is responding, many governments with trade restrictive measures, and many times they're doing the same exact thing. So it's sort of hard to second guess in that context. But I think virus mitigation measures really need to be distinguished from the recovery measures that surely will be coming, right? The virus is intertwined with an economic catastrophe. And when states start opening up, they're even doing it now, states are going to start taking various kinds of measures to promote economic recovery, as well as public health. And those are, I think, going to be a lot more different across national boundaries. It's speculative right now, but it sort of seems obvious. And that's where one might suspect that down the line, dispute resolution will be a little bit trickier, right? It's going to be a lot less simple to justify each country's bespoke measures that are meant to promote economic recovery, but may have potentially discriminatory effects or may involve quotas, which are not permitted in the GATT, things like that, it's going to be harder to justify those under the sort of flexibilities under the treaties. I'm not saying as a legal matter they can't be justified, right? A lot of things can be justified, but the sort of magic bullet of the public health crisis, I think, won't be as readily available. And that's where I think states should have more cause for concern.
Now, of course, we as lay people tend to talk about the global economy through the lens of trade, really. It's the thing that we think about, the way that presidents talk about it, politicians talk about it. But it's really only part of the global economic system. There's a whole separate set of institutions, regimes, and practices built up around the flow of capital, around investment. Ben, let me turn to you about that. Is what Julian's describing in the trade realm also applicable to the investment realm largely? Are we seeing a different set of responses and a different set of legal questions arise there?
I think Julian is broadly right about that, especially distinguishing from sort of immediate crisis responses like a lockdown versus the broader risk associated with the recovery. But there may be some nuance because there's always a difference between trade and investment that's worth drawing out. So just to sort of set the table, you know, the regime governing foreign investment globally is actually more of a regime complex. There's lots of stuff out there, soft guidelines about business and human rights. There's older friendship, commerce, and navigation treaties and so forth. But really, usually when we're talking about investment law today, we're usually talking about bilateral investment treaties or things that look like them. And these are treaties ordinarily between two states that contain obligations to protect each other's investors from certain types of intrusion or harm, like expropriation, and consent to arbitration. So if the United States concludes a bilateral investment treaty with Jamaica, which we have, we promised to Jamaica that we'll treat their investors fairly and we won't expropriate without compensation. And if a Jamaican investor feels like we haven't done that, that investor can sue the United States before an international arbitral tribunal and potentially obtain compensation. And it's reciprocal. So the United States investors enjoy the same rights in Jamaica. And so, you know, there are thousands of these bilateral investment treaties around the world. And these types of investor protections are increasingly incorporated along with this right to arbitration in bilateral or plurilateral trade agreements. So you have the original NAFTA was sort of pioneering in this respect. The CETA, which is the new trade agreement between the EU and Canada, contains these types of rights. The TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, was expected to contain those rights. And the one that exists without the United States today, the CPTPP, has investment protections in it as well. So what are these obligations? They have all types of obligations relating to investment, and these things can all be implicated by both the immediate measures and the long-term crisis measures around COVID-19. So the sort of core obligation, or what I think of as the main historical obligation, is that you don't expropriate property without paying prompt, adequate, and effective compensation. And you know, that could come into play here for direct takings. For example, you know, we've seen some temporary nationalizations of hospitals in some countries. If those become permanent, or even if not, those could implicate those provisions. There's also a jurisprudence around what you might think of as indirect or regulatory takings, where a business is regulated to death such that even if the state doesn't capture the value of the company, but kills it through regulation, there might be a takings claim. So you can imagine lockdown type orders that, especially if that disproportionately affects some businesses, giving rise to claims there, depending on the facts and circumstances, as always, right? You have non-discrimination obligations. States generally aren't supposed to discriminate on the basis of nationality, either among foreign investors from different countries or between foreign investors and sort of domestic investors in these treaties. Those non-discrimination obligations, at least in the U.S. treaties that we've signed with a number of other countries, extend before even an investment is established to what we call pre-establishment obligations. And so these investment screening measures that Kathleen talked about could potentially, if they discriminate among investments from certain places, either explicitly or de facto, could implicate these obligations. There are obligations in some of these treaties relating to respect for contracts that effectively give investors the right to sue a state for a breach of a state contract, like a concession contract. you know, where we see states taking measures for, you know, force majeure or other things to renegotiate or even back out of contracts with investors, those could be implicated. And then finally, there are these broad provisions in many of these treaties requiring non-arbitrary treatment or fair and equitable treatment. And those provisions are sort of open-ended and interpreted rather broadly to import a range of administrative law-like obligations, consistency in the regulatory framework, stability in the regulatory framework, transparency, non-arbitrariness in decision-making, all the sorts of good stuff you learn in administrative law can be incorporated into these rather broad provisions. Now, the remedy for all these breaches typically under an investment treaty is compensation. So whereas, you know, if you have an administrative law claim in a domestic court, often what you might obtain is an injunction to sort of have your permit reassessed or have a rule struck down, and then, you know, the rulemaking process begins anew. In investor state arbitration, the remedy is generally retroactive compensation. That also distinguishes it from the trade regime. So when we're talking about claims at the WTO that might arise from export controls, we're talking about a dispute settlement process that could potentially happen and then end up with a state sort of rescinding its export controls or adjusting them in a particular way to make them WTO compliant going forward. In the investment regime, what we'd be talking about is retroactive compensation. So if a regulation is debilitating to a foreign investor and that investor wins an investment claim, they could potentially try to sue and obtain both, you know, what they've already lost as well as future profits if their investment has gone under. And that's what they will claim, and a tribunal will decide whether they're entitled to it. So that's sort of the basic framework. And that's the concern, right, from states, is that their regulatory flexibility will either be chilled by the threat of investment arbitration, or that they'll take these measures because they have to, and then they'll be punished such that, you know, when they really should be spending money trying to recover or redevelop after the economic and health crisis that is COVID-19, they'll instead be having to pay off foreign investors. So that's the concern on the state side. On the investor side, you know, I think foreign investors are concerned that there's states are taking this opportunity to enact discriminatory policies or even, you know, violate property rights or human rights that could be damaging to foreign investors and to good governance in some states. We haven't seen too much yet concrete about, you know, what is happening on the ground. The one story that did come out in the Global Arbitration Review, which is one of the trade publications, is that Peru has been warned that a measure passed by its legislature could potentially violate investment obligations. And what Peru had done was suspend collection of tolls on both state-run and private toll roads. And while it turns out that those private toll roads include many foreign concessionaires, foreign investors that own state concessions to run toll roads. And so this suspension of collection of tolls, which was meant to free up movement within the country during a time of crisis, is potentially, at least according to some regulators in Peru who are opposed to this legislative measure, a violation of both Peru's national constitution and an investment treaty. So that's the one example we have that's concrete, but, you know, you can imagine many others involving, you know, anything from compulsory licenses to lockdown regulations. And then, as Julian said, as states take divergent paths on the recovery, right, we could imagine various types of Buy America type measures or efforts to reshore manufacturing of essential products as coming into conflict with some of these investment obligations and giving rise to a much wider array of disputes.
So Julian, even before this pandemic broke out, we had already seen the Trump administration take a pretty adversarial stance towards, frankly, a lot of the conventional wisdom behind the current global economic approach, behind international economic institutions, particularly around trade issues and targeted towards the WTO, but other institutions as well. Have we seen the coronavirus amplify these trends or give the Trump administration more space with which to pursue them? And how have these positions affected these institutions' ability to respond to the coronavirus crisis as it relates to trade and investment?
Yeah, so I'm not so sure. You know, this is a difficult one because on the one hand, you know, the damage has already been done, right? I mean, the Trump administration has taken a lot of steps towards undermining, undercutting the WTO, especially, but multilateral institutions more broadly. In the context of the WTO, obviously the marquee move was blocking appointments to the appellate mechanism of the WTO, which is the sort of crown jewel of dispute resolution in the WTO. Every party gets an appeal as of right, but the U.S. has blocked new judges being appointed to the point where the appellate mechanism actually does not have a quorum. So appeals cannot be heard. So therefore, disputes cannot proceed. So this is all really problematic. But in the context of the COVID, I mean, the damage there is done. And I haven't particularly seen the COVID situation amplifying the administration's attempt to further undermine the WTO, putting aside the question of whether some of the sort of fellow travelers of the administration in the Republican Party have been trying to use this opportunity, like Josh Hawley, to push for fully exiting the WTO, right? But the administration hasn't at least gotten there yet publicly. That said, the administration has been using this situation to further their attacks on multilateralism more generally. The WHO, the World Health Organization, is obviously a great example of a sort of new attack on multilateralism. But just more generally, US's measures have been prioritizing unilateralism at every turn. You know, it's hard to know what exactly is real and what's not real. There are sort of reports that the U.S. has been trying to get priority on vaccines, that the U.S. has been trying to freeze out other countries on vaccine development and things like that. If those things are true, I mean, it's perfectly in keeping with some of the sort of skepticism of multilateralism, the prioritization of the national interest over the global interest. Those things wouldn't be particularly surprising to me, right? So I think the way to think of this in terms of COVID and the WTO and multilateralism is that the U.S. has kind of created recently the conditions. They've sort of inserted the termites into the system already. And I don't know that what they've done in the context of the WTO makes it harder for the WTO to manage the COVID situation, because it's not clear to me that the WTO has the sort of forefront role in managing either the COVID situation or the recovery outside of a dispute resolution. The U.S. surely has made dispute resolution much more problematic in the WTO context. But where the U.S.'s actions have become much more problematic and intensified by the COVID situation is the sort of much more general, broad assault on multilateralism. And the COVID situation truly intensifies that. I think it also, you know, perhaps counterintuitively, might strengthen multilateralism in the minds of other countries, right? So it could be that the COVID situation so intensifies the problems arising out of the U.S.'s bailing on the multilateral efforts that it's led for so long that other countries sort of start reassessing whether or not they want to really, how far they want to go along with this. So if I were watching the United States' COVID response from the outside, I may be more inclined than ever to think their way lies madness.
I might just add on to Julian's response, if I may, Scott, that I largely agree. There was Ambassador Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, recently published an op-ed in the New York Times about the way that COVID has accelerated and demonstrated the need to get rid of offshoring, right, to bring jobs home to the United States. And he didn't point to the WTO specifically, as I recall, but more to things like NAFTA that have facilitated those types of offshoring movements with which he is concerned. And I think most folks in response to that, most trade experts and trade lawyers said, well, it's probably not that simple. But to just say, oh, this is, we're going to bring everybody home. The supply chains are more complicated for a reason. But nevertheless, that is one way, at least the administration has tried to tie together the pandemic with its otherwise similarly situated trade policy moves.
Well, let me go back and ask you all specifically about one of the proposals that Julian mentioned, and that is the recent proposal by Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri, I believe, who proposed that the United States should withdraw itself from the World Trade Organization. And has even not only proposed this in an op-ed recently, but also actually has introduced for legislation trying to force a vote on such a measure in the Senate. Is that the sort of measure that seems realistic? Is his assessment of the pros and cons of that approach seem reasonable to you? Or is there something missing from these sorts of bold steps that some people have begun to advocate for? Ben, why don't I start with you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely something missing, which is we don't know what the plan is. So, I mean, if you compare the joint resolution, for example, which was talking about withdrawing from the WTO to the op-ed, in the op-ed in the New York Times, Senator Hawley said we should abolish the WTO. Now, those would be two very different steps, and unfortunately, one of them is impossible. The United States can't unilaterally abolish an international organization. What the United States could do is withdraw from that international organization. And, you know, when you're in a club that moves a lot of money around the entire world, there may be reasons to want to leave that club, but you wouldn't want to leave that club without a plan, right? What's the backup plan? What's the idea? And what seems to be the idea in Senator Hawley's statements is he wants to go back to something like the GATT, and particularly the GATT maybe before the 70s and 80s, when it was really like largely a club of like-minded states subject to Western dominance. You know, and there, you know, like I can sort of understand what's happening. What I see as what's happening is there's really a reconfiguration of how we think about trade and our national security. And this is something I've written about. So, you know, in the 1987 National Security Strategy, the Reagan administration, this is the first national security strategy required by statute, you know, emphasized the United States' role in fostering multilateral cooperation to open borders and trade. If fostering multilateral cooperation would enhance U.S. national security. Now, there were limits to that. In that same document, the Reagan administration said, we don't see any benefit to having the USSR become a member of the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is a precursor to the WTO. But nonetheless, generally, free trade supports U.S. security objectives. Now, in the 90s, that logic was really pressed forward by the Clinton administration. And in the run-up to the Chinese accession to the WTO, you had the argument coming out of the White House that China's accession to the WTO was absolutely in the United States' national security interest, for among other reasons that it would force China to play by the rules and would sort of domesticate China and would be part of a broader strategy to sort of, you know, create a liberal peace with free trade as one of the anchors. You know, that didn't exactly happen as planned. I mean, in some ways, China's played by the rules, and in other ways, it has not. You know, China is a much more significant economic actor today than it was at the time. And now people are thinking about U.S. security interests differently, and they're wondering whether free trade is really always in the U.S. security interests, even if it is generally, whether it's always better to, you know, liberalize rather than to seek self-sufficiency is a different question. So we see that narrative shifting. And I think, If you zoom out from the details of Hawley's op-ed, which are sort of a mess and a hodgepodge of, you know, incoherent talking points, what you see is, you know, him participating in that shifting narrative. And that shifting narrative is real, and I think it's going to be with us for a long time. So if we withdraw from the WTO, what would be the alternative plan? What would a club of like-minded states look like? Well, ironically, it would sort of be the club of mega regionals that the Obama administration was exploring with the TPP and the TTIP. That's the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Latin American and Pacific countries. And then on the other side, a partnership with the EU. And you could imagine a network of mega regional trade treaties that stretched across the globe that provide a different configuration of economic rules that with the United States at the center, and then potentially with China, you know, seeking its own priorities elsewhere. You can imagine that being a possible future, and it doesn't seem that far-fetched. So if we zoom out from the details, I think we might be looking at the genesis of something that's going to be with us for a while. I'm going to reserve judgment on whether it's a good idea.
Well, let's come back to some of the more immediate consequences we can expect from COVID-19 specifically in the short term. In particular, I'm thinking about what we're already beginning to see in the domestic realm, which is litigation over some of these responses to coronavirus. But of course, not just in the domestic realm in this case, but also in regards to international institutions, international for addressing those sorts of disputes. Julian, should we expect a wave of litigation and other claims issues and disputes issues coming forward in response to these sorts of measures? And what should we expect that trend to look like?
Yeah, so I think there's two big distinctions. I mean, the short answer is yes, but I think there's two big distinctions that need to be drawn. The first is the one I mentioned before, the big difference between virus mitigation measures and recovery measures. And the second is the distinction which Ben mentioned between the way that litigation works, the function of litigation in the trade regime, and the function of litigation in the investment treaty regime. So my sort of instinct is that whether or not states or investors are suing in the context of virus mitigation measures, I suspect there will be less suits there. And I suspect dispute resolution bodies will be much, much, much less open to finding states liable for measures that they took to mitigate the spread of the virus, right? You know, especially in investment, there might be some suits, but I'm skeptical. When it comes to the recovery measures, though, so in the context of trade, where disputes are state to state, states sue one another, individuals have no standing. To get a state to sue, you have to go to, you know, in the U.S., you would have to go to the U.S. trade representative and convince them to bring a suit against another country. So states aren't going to be suing other states for taking the kinds of measures that they themselves have took, right? And where there are no damages awards, as Ben mentioned, I think the likelihood is that litigation won't balloon so much. And even if it does, I think the culture of dispute resolution in the trade dispute world is less likely to find these sorts of measures to be violations of the law that cannot be justified. In investment, it's a totally different world of incentives, right? The investors here are going to be private actors who, some of them will be out of business or have taken really significant hits to their businesses, right? And so they will have every incentive to sue, and especially considering that they can seek damages awards, in a lot of these cases, there's going to be no option not to sue, right? You would owe it to your shareholders to sue. And so I think there's a much higher likelihood that investors will be suing. I think there's also a higher likelihood that tribunals will go along with this. Again, not in the context of virus mitigation measures. There, I'd be skeptical, even though one could imagine some investors trying to sue there, maybe in the interest of settlement shopping or trying to sort of chill a regulatory effort, if that's possible. It's at least colorable to me. But once we start to talk about the recovery measures, I can imagine a lot of investors suing, a wave of investment suits. And I can imagine, for very different institutional cultural reasons, investor state tribunals being more inclined to go along with those sorts of suits. The law of justification is less clear in investment, as Ben mentioned. There are plenty of institutional reasons to keep these suits going in the context of investment, where investors are the ones who bring the suits in the first place. So the incentives across the board are much more oriented towards litigation, I would think. And to me, that's quite troubling.
I do think there are some domestic cases to watch out for in this space too, though, Scott, to your question, that we could see and likely will see some litigation on the way U.S. trade agencies are managing the processes, at least on this side in the Court of International Trade, in the same way that the courts have now gotten in the game on the national security tariffs, as I discussed in my Lawfare post earlier this week. So we will see action, I think, on both fronts.
Well, Kathleen, let me turn back to you on the question about another front here, because, of course, as we know, you know, these are litigation choices, dispute settlement or dispute resolution choices are one method of remedy that states have settled on making available. But it's not the only remedy. States also can pursue policy. The entire trade and investment regime is a product of international agreements pursued by states, and they can pursue changes to that. They can adopt policies. They can adopt new treaties. Have we seen efforts to coordinate some sort of multilateral response to adapt existing institutions and practices to better address coronavirus challenges? And if so, what is that going to look like?
Well, actually, today, as we're recording this here on May 15th, the WTO General Council is having exactly that conversation. And I've seen some early statements coming out of today's meeting that suggest states are trying to make exactly that point, that we need to focus our attention on the future and how to deal with the many, many measures that I mentioned at the outset of our conversation. We've also seen two comments from the G20 committing themselves to opening trade, minimizing stockpiling, coordinating on trade facilitation, that is those customs movements that I mentioned earlier, trying to get products in when they can as quickly as they can, reducing tariffs on health and hygiene products. Those conversations have been going for a long time and now seem more important than ever, harmonizing standards on things like equipment, all of this, especially with an attention to IP regimes, intellectual property regimes, to get access to new technologies as vaccines are developed and so forth. So the G20 coming out strong, a group of 50 states in mid-April made a strong statement about not restricting food and the importance of keeping food moving around the world to avoid shortages. So those strong statements are out there. At the same time that we have these statements coming out, though, I think there are some more mixed signals to watch. It's easy to over-attribute certain trade policy choices to the pandemic. It makes a fairly straightforward scapegoat, and at the same time, it is a legitimate concern. So you have things that are obviously connected, like recently China told Australia that it may not be importing as much of its beef and barley after Australia decided that it wanted to push for an investigation into China's role with the virus at the early stages. So you see that sort of tit for tat. You see Argentina leaving talks in the South American trade bloc of Mercosur, saying it can't really focus on that right now. It has more pressing issues at home. So how much of that is attributable is difficult to say in those sorts of situations. But there are at least three areas where I think the pandemic has suggested we need some reevaluation at the multilateral level, and states are, I think, tuned into these. One is information sharing and transparency. Another is how to deal with this lack of predictability in these types of crises and the disparate impact that it has on developing states as compared to developed states that rely on things like services where you have to be in person. Think about the Caribbean and tourism as compared to services that you can all do from your home, like perhaps IT or insurance. And finally, a reevaluation of supply chain management, which has really been, I think, the key phrase that we keep seeing, supply chains and value change and what we should all take away from this experience. This is not just a tier one level problem, but you can't get the inputs from one place to another. And so we're all sort of stuck, and that requires a multilateral solution.
And of course, you know, states aren't the only actors that have a vested interest in these questions. Of course, private companies, private actors do as well. And the coronavirus is kind of notable, at least domestically, in cases where it's a time in which we've seen a number of corporations operate in a way that isn't always directly serving their bottom line, whether it's companies shifting to production of medical technology or medical equipment that's badly needed, adopting certain types of leave policies and things like that, and proving that they need to adapt in a way to their workers. That's embraced in some cases, certainly not all cases, but in some cases, a little different view of their obligations in regards to shareholders or employees and how those things are balanced out. Are we seeing any sorts of calls at the international level for private actors to similarly adapt their behavior to some vision of the greater good or the common good, temporarily or permanently? Ben, let me turn to you for that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one thing that really leaps to mind are these recent calls for some version of a moratorium on investor-state dispute settlements. So we've already talked about, as Julian mentioned, in the investment regime, investors sort of have a unilateral right to initiate a case or to threaten a suit. And there's concern that this could have a chilling effect or sort of a deleterious effect on the COVID response. You know, the jury's out on whether that's true or not, but that's the concern. Now, so if you're one of a couple of thousand subscribers to an email list out of Columbia University, you received an email last week from the economist Jeffrey Sachs calling for an immediate moratorium on all ISDS claims, regardless of what they're related to, and a permanent restriction on any claims that would arise out of COVID-19 responses. Sachs was not specific as to the legal mechanism that would be used to achieve this, but, you know, it could be done through some sort of multilateral arrangement, or maybe even through some sort of voluntary pledge where foreign investors, you know, decline to bring such claims. So that's one area. The International Institute for Sustainable Development has created a draft text that they're seeking comments on right now that would actually implement a suspension of ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, for COVID-19 related measures. And so this is coming out of an NGO, and it's being shopped to states as something they could sign on to and suspend investor state arbitration. I've written about that, and I'm generally in support of the proposal. Thinking a little more long term, you might want to think in investment agreements about, you know, what role there is for investor obligations. In some new models of investment treaties, you see sections on the duties that attach to being a foreign investor, duties to respect human rights and sustainable investment goals and policies, or protect the environment, consult indigenous groups, and so on, right? You can see those being looked at again after this crisis. And then there's the second question of how those will be actionable. You know, would states be able to raise breaches of those duties as defenses or counterclaims and proceedings, or even able to initiate some sort of proceeding under the treaty itself to make the investment treaty more of a two-way street? So that's a conversation that was already happening before this crisis. And I think this crisis is going to be incorporated into and potentially drive that conversation going forward.
So we're almost out of time, but I do want to close with a question for all three of you. And that is that, based off your experience as practitioners, as professors, as government representatives in a number of cases, you know, we are witnessing an era here with the coronavirus that is going to have massive implications in a lot of realms, not least this area of the global economy. What are the big changes that you see coming or potentially coming down the pike? What are the things we really should be looking for in regard to those changes, the trends, the warning signs? What are the big takeaways, the things that need to be on our radar as we think about the global economy in this new era we're operating in? Julian, let me come to you first.
Sure. So I want to give a sort of a very lawyerly answer, but you know, the three of us have been thinking a lot about the question of justification in the context of the pandemic. And you know, one conclusion that I think we all reached early on was that, you know, if the law of justification means anything, you know, response to a global pandemic crisis is going to have to pass muster, right? That's going to have to be the situation, at least a situation, where a state has a good justification to avoid its disciplines under international trade treaties, under international investment treaties. And then I think predictively, it's pretty likely that a lot of tribunals are going to accept that type of justification. But one thing that worries me is that it's almost too good of an example. And to the extent that we spend as a community of lawyers, of scholars, of litigators, putting too much, investing too much in making crystal clear how perfect, how archetypal a situation this COVID situation is, this global health crisis is, as a justifiable situation in which you would avoid your obligations under international economic law, I would worry about the anchoring effect. Right. So my concern is that the more we emphasize how this is the perfect case of justification, the greater the risk of raising the bar for establishing a justification under the flexibilities that we have under the trade regime, under the various free trade agreements, which have been less tested than the WTO, under the investment treaty regime. So to me, I think the task is for all of us to explain, yes, indeed, this is the kind of situation in which there needs to be flexibility, but there are many other types of situations in which flexibility is important. And it's really incumbent upon us to preserve the legal flexibilities that we've built into this regime over the several decades and to protect them going forward.
Ben, what about you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, I think two things. One is sort of a more lawyerly comment, as Julian said, and one maybe a little bit less lawyerly. So on the lawyerly nuts and bolts, I think this crisis is going to teach us that we, as international economic lawyers, perhaps we need to focus a little bit more on the transnational regulatory cooperation and rulemaking side of things, and maybe less on dispute settlement. You know, coming out of this, what I would like to see is more focus on how states can engage with each other in moments like this, you know, share information about the kinds of restrictions they're doing, so at least everybody's aware of what everybody else is doing, share best practices, negotiate, you know, in the event of disagreement and so forth, and see less emphasis on the role of adjudication and especially of retroactive compensation for, especially for these types of moments. So that's my sort of lawyerly thought. More broadly, I think what we're seeing is a discussion about, you know, how centered trade and investment really is going to be in the global order writ large. I mean, if you were going to conferences 10, 15 years ago with me, 10 years ago, I mean, come on, what you would hear is everybody else in every other area, from health to environment to energy security, being jealous of the WTO and its dispute settlement mechanism, being jealous of things like investor-state arbitration, and saying, like, why can't we have these mechanisms for our rules and for our systems? Because we have to rely on much softer forms of cooperation and enforcement. And so there was a way in which the WTO and trade and investment were really at the center of the global institutional order. And there's a way in which we're thinking about decentering that. So, you know, folks like Danny Roderick are writing about that. The new UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Michael Fakhry, is a trade lawyer, but he's writing about it from a food perspective. And I think that thinking about the institutional landscape more broadly and where trade and investment are going to fit in and what the priorities are going to be is a really interesting academic project, but it may also be a very real practical project going forward.
Kathleen, we'll give you the closing word.
Well, I agree fully with everything that Julian and Ben just said, and I have maybe three big takeaways from my side, which are really, at least in part, elaborations on things that they mentioned. The first goes to something Julian said earlier, that is that the important moment perhaps is not so much now from a trade and investment perspective, from an international economic law perspective. It's what's yet to come and whether we bounce back normatively, whether the exceptions become normalized, as I've written, or whether they sort of fade into the background. The tools that are being used right now, the many tools that we have, they're not new, but the emphasis or the shift to them becoming the mainstream view is. And as protectionism, especially export protectionism, may be contagious, as Chad Bown has said, I think he's right, there is a domino effect here and a ratcheting up that we may see unless things significantly change. So that's the first. The second is, to Ben's point, thinking about reconciling or accommodating, or I'm not quite sure what the right verb is, but health and international economic law. We had to ask that question, and we have asked that question a number of different times, and we sort of think of it as trade and or trade plus. But that's a very trade-centric approach, right? And when we had to deal with the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, we kind of fumbled around trying to think about what do we do in an emergency situation. This is yet another type of emergency, of course, and health and science-related questions are even more challenging. So health doesn't currently drive our institutional framework, but what if it did? We haven't really wrestled with that, and we probably should. And the third takeaway from my side, I think, is reconciling domestic and international policies, an ongoing challenge that we have been dealing with in international economic law. We still don't have a system that can readily accommodate an internally and externally coherent policy space. It's constantly being challenged and discussed. And that's a lot in part of everything that's going on. It's part of everything that's going on. It's a result of the sort of tradification that's adding a lot to the trade space on the U.S. side and beyond. But it's also about these different narratives, changing the conversation, the emphasis. And it means that both states and scholars and others may need to reappraise and adjust just to get that calibration right.
Well, that unfortunately brings us to time, but this has been a fantastically illuminating conversation about a complex and fast-moving area of the law and of policy. Thank you all so much for joining us today here on the Lawfare Podcast. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet,
please take a moment to share the podcast on Facebook or Twitter and give us a rating and write a review wherever you found us. And be sure to visit the Lawfare Store at www.thelawfarestore.com for all your Lawfare swag needs. The podcast is produced by Zach Frank of Goat Rodeo, edited by Jem Patcha Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.